This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, listeners. This is Ken Pajeris bringing you Time Magazine for this week, the second part of our double issue for March 23rd, 2026, Volume 207, Numbers 9 and 10. We'll begin our reading this week with some feature articles. The first one's entitled Trump's War: The President's Massive Gamble in the Middle East. Eric Cortaleza is the author. President Donald Trump had just arrived at Mar-a-Lago on Friday night, February 27th, when he got word from the U.S. intelligence officials. They believed they had located Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Months had passed since Trump began preparing for the possibility of war with Iran. In recent weeks, he had instructed military officials to draw up operational plans for a joint strike, coordinated closely with Israel. 8 months after the bombing, three Iranian nuclear sites, he had once again getting edgy about the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. The latest round of negotiations in Geneva had done little to reassure him. Trump was suspicious that Tehran was preparing an attack on America and Israeli targets. Though the U.S. had positioned a carrier strike group in the region with another on its way, Iranian negotiators showed little urgency to reach a deal, he notes, proposing to meet again in a week with U.S. envoys. Quote, when I heard that, Trump said, I said, you know, they're going to hit first. As guests partied on one side of his oceanfront mansion and private club, Trump huddled with top military and intelligence brass on the other, where he made the decision to launch a decapitation strike against the Iranian regime. Quote, we went away early, Trump explains in on March 4th phone call with Time. We were going to do it in another week. In the early hours of Saturday morning, the start of the work week in Tehran, Operation Epic Fury began. American long-range missiles and drones were moved in concert with Israeli jets, striking hundreds of Iranian military installations, missile batteries, naval vessels, air defense systems, and command centers. It was one of the region's most expansive air operations in decades. The bombardment killed Khamenei, who presided over an aggressive regime for 36 years. Also dead were a cluster of senior Iranian officials envisioned as potential successors. Quote, I've killed all their leaders, Trump said. That room is gone. The attacks also inflicted significant damage to civilian areas. In the far south of Iran, more than 150 people were killed when a barrage hit a girls' school. Iran retaliated with missile and drone bombardments against the U.S. bases and allied territory, targeting military facilities across the Gulf, including Al Udeid Air Force Base in Qatar. One Iranian drone killed six American service members at a U.S. command center in Kuwait. Asked whether Americans should be worried about retaliatory attacks at home, Trump acknowledged the possibility. I guess, he says, but I think they're worried about all that in time. We think about it all the time. We plan for it. But yeah, you know, we expect some things. Like I said, some people will die. When you go to war, some people will die. Trump promised to end wars, not start them. Instead, he deployed military force in an increasingly dizzying way. No other modern American leader has directed assaults in as many countries in such a short span of time. Since returning to office, Trump has authorized attacks in 8 nations, 3 of which have never been before directly targeted by U.S. forces. In 2025 alone, he approved more individual airstrikes than his predecessors did over 4 years. Trump has ordered a major campaign of airstrikes targeting Houthi-controlled areas in Yemen, authorized naval attacks on vessels from Venezuela suspected of drug trafficking, and signed off on the operation that seized that country's authoritarian president, Nicolas Maduro, left more than 100 dead, and placed the Venezuelan leader on trial in New York. Just days after the onslaught against Tehran, the U.S. took part in a joint military operation in Ecuador, targeting designated terrorist organizations. His administration has also fixed its sights on Cuba, where President Miguel Díaz-Canel has ramped up military exercises amid reports that Trump has asked advisors to devise plans to end the island's six-decade communist rule. In short, if Trump campaigned as a president of peace, he is governed as the opposite. Now he has drawn the U.S. into a kind of conflict he long pledged to avoid. Having ousted the tyrannical ruler of Iran's theocracy, he has committed the U.S. anew to regime change in the Middle East, telling time he intends to play a role in shaping the next government of a regional powerhouse, home to some 90 million people. One quote, one of the things I'm going to be asking for is the ability to work with them on choosing a new leader, he says. I'm not going through this to end up with another Khomeini. I want to be involved in the selection. They can select, but we have to make sure it's somebody that's reasonable to the United States. It's impossible to know how all of this will unfold. There was little sympathy internationally for Ayatollah, who reigned over a brutal Islamist regime. Throughout Tehran and across the Iranian diaspora, crowds have rejoiced in the streets upon hearing the news of his demise. To some, Trump's attacks are historic in the best sense, eliminating an avowed adversary who sought to destroy the U.S. and whom Washington has long viewed as the head of the world's foremost state-sponsored of terrorism. But the gambit carried extraordinary risks. For Trump presidency, for Iran's fragile political future, and for regional stability and the safety of all Americans at home and abroad. The greatest decision a president can make is whether to send American troops in harm's way. Trump, who once defined himself as opposition to foreign entanglements, has pivoted with astonishing acridity toward open-ended confrontation across multiple theaters. In his interview with Time, Trump says his goals are to eliminate Iran's nuclear threat once and for all, to dismantle its ballistic missile program, and to install a Western-friendly government. Quote, we have to be able to deal with the sane and rational people, he says. Wow, that's weird. Yet Trump launched a war before making it a case to the country or to Congress, and his administration has offered unclear and sometimes contradictory explanations of the mission's objectives. The most unnerving possibility is that Operation Epic Fury is not the culmination of his shift toward war presidency, but rather the beginning of a new chapter. The path to war with Iran was paved by a pair of meetings 1 year apart with Benjamin Netanyahu, On February 24, 2025, the Israeli Prime Minister visited the White House for the first time since Trump's return to power. Seated at a long table in the cabinet room, Netanyahu began with a bracing reminder. According to the U.S. and Israeli officials present at the meeting, Iran, he noted, had plotted to assassinate Trump during the 2024 campaign. Law enforcement officials disclosed they had disrupted what they described as two Iranian plots to kill Trump. Tehran denied the allegations. Trump has long fused geopolitics with grievance, and Iran's clerical leadership occupied a singular place on his list of adversaries. When Time asked him in November 2024 interview about the prospect of war with Iran, Trump did not dismiss it. "Anything can happen," he says. Sensing an opening, Netanyahu walked through a slide deck. It showed stockpiles of highly enriched uranium climbing, centrifuges spinning faster, inspectors reporting gaps. Ever since Trump withdrew from President Barack Obama's nuclear accord in 2018, Tehran had incrementally expanded its enrichment program, moving closer to breakout capacity. By the time Trump was inaugurated the second time, international inspectors assessed that Iran possessed enough weapons-grade uranium to place it mere weeks from assembling a bomb. Quote, "Look, Donald," Netanyahu said, leaning in, "this has to be tackled. Because they're racing forward." He paused, locked eyes with the president. "You can't have a nuclear Iran on your watch." But Trump was not ready to greenlight an Israeli strike. He wanted diplomatic attempts first and tasked his longtime friend and real estate developer, Steve Witkoff, with exploring a solution. U.S. and Israeli officials settled on a 60-day framework to test whether an agreement was viable. The Israeli officials say the deadline was strategic. When Iran exceeded it without concessions, they argued, Trump's skepticism hardened. Quote, "It proved to Trump that we have nobody to talk to," one official says. It was a ruse. After the International Atomic Energy Agency reported that Iran had concealed aspects of its nuclear development in violation of a prior commitment, Israeli intelligence was shared with White House, purporting to show Tehran was slow-walking negotiations while covertly assembling components necessary for a weapon. On June 13, 2025, Jerusalem launched a wave of strikes that broke through Iranian air defenses and disrupted supply lines. Trump was impressed. And, as one of his advisors put it, eager not to be a spectator to history. On June 22nd, Trump authorized Operation Midnight Hammer, a tightly coordinated onslaught on three of Iran's most critical nuclear sites, Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. 14 GBU-15 massive ordnance penetrator bombs were delivered by B-2 stealth bombers in what officials described as the largest such mission in American history. The objective was explicit: penetrate hardened facilities and degrade Iran's capacity to cross the nuclear threshold. Assessments of the damage varied. Though analysts urged caution, Trump declared the facilities effectively destroyed. When Iran's retaliatory missile strikes on the U.S. bases appeared largely symbolic, intercepted or limited in scope. He proclaimed the 12-day war over. Tehran would have a choice, he said. Negotiate a permanent end to its nuclear ambitions or face future consequences. Over time, Trump saw the strike as a success on multiple levels. After his administration helped broker a Gaza ceasefire that secured the return of Israeli hostages led by Hamas, he framed Operation Midnight Hammer, along with his first-term assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, as leverage, proof that credible force could reset diplomatic equations. Quote, it would have been impossible to make a deal like this before, Trump told Time last fall. No president was willing to do it, and I was willing to do it, and by doing it, we had a different Middle East. To some, Midnight Hammer validated a doctrine of decisive action, limited in duration, but maximal in force. To others, it normalized Trump's ordering preventative strikes against sovereign nations with uncertain long-term consequences. Either way, the operation fed Trump's own sense of momentum. It also created the foundations of a new template. Apply overwhelming force, declare victory, then offer negotiation from a position of dominance. By year's end, Trump was no longer speaking of war as something to avoid at all costs, but as an instrument to achieve his ends. Smaller operations soon flickered across the map. Military strikes against suspected narcotics vessels in the Caribbean. Joint raids with regional partners targeting cartel infrastructure along Venezuela's coast. Covert actions against criminal networks in Ecuador. The crescendo came in January, when American Special Operations Forces launched a pre-dawn attack on Caracas that ended with the capture of Maduro and his transfer to the U.S. to face narcotics terrorism charges. The focus of diplomacy was then shifted back to Iran's nuclear program. Trump tapped two trusted envoys to pursue the deal. Trusted, but not very bright. Witkoff and son-in-law Jared Kushner, the millionaire, who had negotiated the Gaza deal and were leading the administration's efforts to broker peace between Russia and Ukraine. Their mandate was straightforward, if ironic, to secure an agreement not unlike the Iranian nuclear accord forged by Obama, the very deal Trump had excoriated and withdrawn from in his first term. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic was violently suppressing anti-government protests across the country. Trump saw an opening. He told the demonstrators that help is on the way and warned Tehran a military response was on the table, though took no action, as Iranian authorities shut down the internet and slaughtered as many as 30,000 people. According to senior administration officials, Trump thought pressure from the streets combined with the American threats would force Iran to the negotiating table. But Witkoff and Kushner's attempts to forge a deal in Geneva went nowhere. When the envoys returned empty-handed, Trump concluded the Iranians were playing for time, using what one senior U.S. official described as games, tricks, and stall tactics. Iran refused to entertain negotiations over two issues that the Western officials considered central: its ballistic missile program and its support for regional proxy forces, including Hezbollah and Hamas. Then, two developments accelerated the shift toward confrontation, according to two of Trump's officials familiar with the deliberations. The first was an intelligence assessment indicating that Iran was preparing ballistic missile strikes that could be used potentially preemptively against American forces in the region. The president decided he was not going to sit back and allow American forces in the Middle East to absorb attacks from conventional missiles, one official told reporters. The second was Netanyahu's parallel march toward war. Quote, we knew that there was going to be an Israeli action, Secretary of State Mario Rubio said on March 2nd. We knew that that would be precipitate an attack against American forces. And we knew that if we didn't preemptively go after them before they launched those attacks, we would suffer high casualties. On February 11th, Netanyahu returned to Washington for a meeting with Trump that participants described as unusually grave. There were none of Trump's customary wisecracks, no theatrical sides. For 3 hours, the two men sat together at the White House, working through operational plans and the parameters of coordination campaign. Trump has previously told Time he does not trust the Israeli premier. I don't trust anybody. But now they were working in lockstep in an operation that could alter the balance of power in the region. By the time Netanyahu left Washington, the outlines of the attack were set. In a little more than 2 weeks, the first bombs would fall on Tehran. Even those with only a passing familiarity with Middle East history can imagine the grim scenarios that could unfold from here. When George W. Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq in 2003, members of administration predicted that American troops would be greeted as liberators after the fall of Saddam Hussein. For a fleeting moment, that seemed possible, plausible. Then the war curdled into a quagmire that destabilized the region, drained American lives and treasures, boosted Iran, and helped fuel a wave of radicalization whose repercussions will ripple throughout the global politics. It was amid the fatigue and the disillusionment from those wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan that Trump forged his America First identity. He has now launched a war that could carry many of the same risks. Quote, even if scenarios where we had, like in Iraq or Afghanistan, were some degree of planning for the day after, it ended in grief, says Ali Vaez, an expert on Iran with the International Crisis Group in Geneva. Quote, this time around, it is really based on wishful thinking. Trump made only a cursory effort to notify Congress before launching the attack, briefing a small circle of congressional leaders shortly before the operation was underway, and leaving most lawmakers to learn of it after the fact. There has been little public debate beforehand about the possibility of war, including in his State of the Union address just days earlier. In the aftermath, of some officials framed the strike as a necessary act of preemption against an imminent threat. Others described it as a long-planned effort to cripple Iran's military leadership and force a broader political reckoning in Tehran. Rubio's statement that Israel was preparing an attack of its own and that Washington moved first to weaken Iran before it could retaliate against American targets was yet another rationale. In his phone call with Time, Trump described the mission as preventative. Quote, America First is really about keeping America healthy and well, and not having other countries, you know, hit us, he says. There are occasions when you have no choice. This was an occasion. The aim, he says, is to prevent Iran from having the capacity to endanger the U.S. Quote, they can't have a nuclear weapon. That's number one, two, and three. Number four, no ballistic missiles, he says. Another objective Trump tells Time, is installing somebody that is rational and sane to lead Iran. Some experts say the U.S. may not be able to engineer a successor government more stable than the one it seeks to replace. Quote, this is not a regime of individual leaders. It's a regime of well-entrenched institutions that have a monopoly on coercion, says Suzanne Maloney, an Iran expert at the Brookings Institution. Quote, other than just a continuous process of assassination, I'm not entirely clear on how the president anticipates he's going to be able to determine the next leader of Iran. Others argue that the danger may run still deeper, that the fall of the Islamic Republic could fracture Iran rather than reform it, unleashing internal power struggles, proxy conflicts, or even a civil war. The Trump administration is betting on the possibility that Iran's population might welcome outside pressure against its clerical regime. Iran is a young country. More than 40% of its population is under 30. And many of those citizens have lived their entire lives under sanctions, repression, and economic stagnation. Trump's advisors believe that resentment toward the ruling establishment could produce change, particularly if a new government could quickly align with regional powers such as Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states that have grown closer to the U.S. and Israel in many recent years. But that hope collides with the harsher reality. Popular dissatisfaction does not automatically translate into revolution. Protesters lack weapons and organization. The Iranian security apparatus does not. If the regime endures or violently suppresses aggress again, the U.S. could face a decision it has tried to avoid, whether to send in ground forces to finish the job. Trump has not ruled out that possibility. He says he believes the objectives of the campaign would be achieved within 4 or 5 weeks, though he concedes the timeline could stretch longer. The war will continue, he suggests, until those objectives are accomplished. Quote, I have no time limits on anything, he says. I want to get it done. Trump's abrupt reversal on foreign intervention is testing the coalition that carried him back to power. Fissures have emerged on the right, with longtime allies questioning the scope and purpose of the campaign, reviving the anti-interventionist strain that once defined the MAGA movement. Tucker Carlson and Megyn Kelly have each accused Israel of dragging the U.S. into a misadventure overseas. Marjorie Taylor Greene, once Trump's most steadfast allies, but now an increasingly vocal critic, accused him of betraying the movement. Quote, this is not what we thought MAGA was supposed to be, she wrote on X. Shame! Other detractors have argued that the war may come to resemble a wag the dog moment for a president facing soft approval numbers, the Epstein scandal, and economic unease ahead of the midterms. How Trump responds to these pressures may determine how long the war continues, especially if it grows unpopular. The dynamic is one that haunted Bush, whose war in Iraq became so politically toxic that members of his own party abandoned him. The irony would be profound. Trump, who electrified Republican politics in part by repudiating the foreign policy legacy of the Bush family, could find himself ensnared by the very forces that helped undo that dynasty. Trump believes the outcome will be different this time. In the past, such as in Venezuela, he has launched dramatic military actions and disengaged before they were hardened into protracted wars. But this is far bigger. and riskier gamble. As he readily acknowledges, and the consequences are less predictable. As the conflict unfolds, the question that hangs over Washington is the same one that has haunted commanders-in-chief for generations. Presidents may choose how the war begins, but many may choose, but they don't get to decide how it ends. We continue on this topic for Time Magazine for this week with a follow-up article, Reaction, Inside Iran, Jubilation Quickly Followed by Apprehension. K. Arman Segouri is the author. In Tehran, the war found a contractor named Salman as he was toweling off. Quote, I had just stepped out of the shower, he said, getting prepared to go out, when the sound of low-flying aircraft startled me. Out his window, he saw two columns of black smoke above the compound of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It had been hit in the first wave of U.S.-Israeli airstrikes. When his death was confirmed, celebrations broke out across the country. Quote, I feel a trembling inside me, a feeling I've never experienced in my life, said Mehdi, an engineer in the eastern city of Mashhad. I think this may be the most important moment of my life. Someone has died who killed all my dreams. It's as if I'm dreaming, said Hassan, 41, a Tehran lawyer. The worry that the regime might not fall even after his death keeps me from being fully happy. But I keep reminding myself that nothing was more terrifying than being alive. In a video message, President Donald Trump urged Iranians to stay inside while the U.S. and Israeli forces carried out their assault. Quote, when we're finished, take over your government, he said. It will be yours to take. Hearing that, a 47-year-old Tehran businessman named Mohsin unpacked the car he was about to take his family away in. Quote, when I heard Trump say that, say stay in your homes, and I take over the country when he's finished, I changed my mind. How can I go to the streets if I'm not in Tehran? Before the week was out, however, events had tempered. The initial enthusiasm after the massacre of thousands of protesters in January, Soror, who works as a clerk in Tehran, welcomed the assault as the only way we can get rid of this regime. Then she found herself parked at a gas station when the airstrike destroyed the building beside it. Quote, as soon as I got out, I slipped. I looked down and saw I was standing and spilled out guts of a motorcyclist who had been filling up. She found bits of flesh and brain in her hair and now showers compulsively. Quote, the number one thing we need to do now, she says, is fight the Americans and the Israelis. Others reached by Time were alarmed by the news reports that the CIA is arming militias in Iran's Kurdish minority, some of which harbor separatist aspirations. Quote, for years, the regime used this as a pretext to frighten people and to prevent them from rising up, notes Behrouz, an engineer in Tehran. Only during the nationwide solidarity of 2022 protests over the death of Mahsa Amini did people realize that this is just regime propaganda, he says. Quote, I can't imagine how dumb Trump and Netanyahu have to be to prove the Islamic Republic right. For Heshmat, 42, a Tehran businessman, the threat was visceral. Quote, the first things these Kurdish militia would do is start massacring Turks, Iran's Turks, in Azerbaijan province, he said. Quote, I'm originally from Tabriz. My family is still mostly there. We have to defend our family, and honestly, I don't think it would be possible without getting a hold of arms. Iran's borders include a host of other ethnic minorities as well. Quote, if Kurdish militia attack, it's not going to stop the Kurdish regions. Stop in the Kurdish regions, says Behrouz. Soon the Turks will also rise up, and then Baluch, then the Arabs. Iran will disintegrate. I've been fighting the Islamic Republic for years. I've been doing all I can to get rid of them, because that's the only way we can have a free Iran, a democratic Iran. But the prerequisites to all these things is that there is an Iran, that it exists. In another follow-up article, obituary, the life of sanctimony and violence, by Carl Vick. The years did not mellow Ali Khamenei. Appointed supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran at age 50, he was the longest-serving ruler in the Middle East at the time of his death at 86 on February 28, 2026. The Islamic Republic had been founded by his mentor, Ruhollah Khomeini, the Grand Ayatollah, who after the 1979 revolution replaced a monarchy with theocracy. But it was Khomeini who ruled for three-quarters of the Republic's existence, transforming it into a de facto military dictatorship. Sometimes clothes do make the man. Khomeini wore the turban of a senior Shiite cleric, but the pale plaid kerchief, often looped around his neck, was favored by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC. The Praetorian Force he elevated to near co-ruler status. By the early 2000s, the Guard had consolidated military, political, and economic power so extensively that a prominent Iranian economist remarked, with raised eyebrows, that the only comparison was to the National Socialism in 1930s Germany. If that arrangement solidified Khomeini's rule, it left little for Iran's 93 million people, and even less after the regime's pursuit of a nuclear weapon triggered intensifying international sanctions that sent the economy into a free fall at the end of 2025. With hard currency reserves depleted and inflation soaring, Iranians took to the streets en masse, chanting for the regime's downfall. On Khomeini's orders, security forces killed an estimated 30,000 people, according to senior health officials. Over the following 2 months, President Trump opened negotiations over Iran's nuclear program while deploying two aircraft carrier groups and additional warplanes to the region, the largest U.S. military buildup there since 2003 invasion of Iraq. An armada that was finally unleashed on Iran in the early hours of February 28. Iran's supreme leader was killed that morning in an opening barrage as a joint U.S. and Israeli artillery assault targeted military and government sites across the country. Trump confirmed the death in a post on Truth Social, writing, Khomeini is one of the most evil people in the history. And he's dead. You should know what evil's like. Decades, four decades, Khomeini had sought to defy both the U.S., the great Satan, leading a godless West, and Israel, while adhering to the overriding imperative, preserve the regime at all costs. That imperative may explain why in his later years he spent extended periods underground. The bunker beneath his compound in central Tehran lies so deep that one visitor timed the elevator descent in more than 5 minutes. After June 2025, when Israel for 12 days and the U.S. for one launched strikes aimed at crippling Iran's nuclear program and decapitating the IRGC leadership, Khomeini curtailed public appearances. He stopped holding regular meetings with Iran's elected officials. and emerged only for defiant speeches in a controlled environment. Quote, an aircraft carrier is a dangerous machine, he acknowledged in February 17th speech. But even more dangerous than that is the weapon capable of sending it to the bottom of the sea. The son of a cleric, Khomeini, grew up in modest circumstances in the eastern city of Mashhad. As a religious student, he gravitated toward the Shiite thinkers who fused political absolutism with theology. He became the unlikely figure, a militant cleric. During the 1960s and 70s, he endured torture and solitary confinement in prisons in the U.S.-backed Shah, whose overthrow became the central product of his youth. After the Islamic Revolution, as a key aide to Khomeini, he rose quickly. In 1981, he was about to address a news conference. A bomb planted by a rival faction exploded beside him, leaving his dominant right hand effectively useless and him in chronic pain. Months later, when Iran's president, Mohammad Ali Rajah, and 99 others were killed in another bombing, Khomeini was chosen as his successor. In his inaugural address, he denounced deviation, liberalism, and American-influenced leftists, previewing a tenure defined by ideological rigidity. When Khomeini died in 1989, shortly after accepting a ceasefire in the eight-year war with Iraq to preserve the regime, he said, there was no clear successor. Khomeini recently returned from a trip to North Korea and China, was the only junior cleric in the Shiite tradition noted for its adherence to hierarchy, but a battlefield promotion by Ayatollah was arranged, blending faith with politics in an exercise that critics said sullied both, even before Khomeini reinforced his position as by earthly means, elevating the IRGC. On state television, Khomeini projected an unvocular demeanor. His spectacles framed a sharp gaze. Visiting journalists were informed that his favorite novel was Les Miserables, and that in a scholaric theocracy, his wristwatch signaled modern tastes. But when delivering Friday sermons, he rested his good hand on the barrel of a rifle. In the 1990s, Iranian voters expressed their appetite for relief from the structures of fundamentalist rule by voting overwhelmingly to elect reformist figures to the presidency and parliament, part of the government that operated below the upper tiers controlled by unelected clerics. Khomeini moved to contain it. Over time, the newspapers were closed, dissidents jailed, and candidates kept off the ballot. At one point, Khomeini ordered the beating of his own brother, a cleric aligned with reform. After the disputed 2009 presidential election, in which an apparent reformist victory was thwarted, the streets became the only outlet for dissent. By all accounts, Khomeini lived modestly. Yet, a 2013 Reuters investigation estimated that he controlled assets worth $95 billion through a network of foundations and holdings. In a country where government ministry reported in 2023 that more than half the population was malnourished, such figures fueled resentment. Bloomberg reported in January that his 56-year-old son, Mojtaba, long viewed as a potential successor, owned more than $100 million in luxury properties abroad. The IRGC controlled roughly 30% of Iran's economy, according to one of its founders, Mohsen Zaghara, now exiled, an exiled dissident. When a new airport opened outside Tehran in 2004, the guards asserted control by rolling tanks onto the runways. Its members dominate major sectors of the industry and oversee Iran's vast smuggling networks. Over time, power in the Islamic Republic operated like that of a royal court. Khomeini married before the revolution to a woman whose photograph and even his first name were not made public until her own death on March 2nd, which an official news agency attributed to injuries sustained in an airstrike that also killed her husband. The marriages of their children and siblings were widely known, however, doubling as alliances into political factions, the clerical hierarchy, and the unelected institutions that ultimately answered to the supreme leader. Karim Sajapour of the Carnegie Institute for International Peace, who has written extensively on Khomeini, said he governed Iran as a cause, not a country. Historically known as Persia, the country has endured for more than 2,500 years. The cause, however, has been hurting. Despite years of reports about his declining health, Khomeini did not publicly designate his successor. He was said to have regarded Qasem Soleimani, the charismatic IRGC general, as a son, however, until President Trump ordered his killing in a 2020 drone strike. Soleimani was in charge of Iran's sprawling network of proxy forces, extending from Iraq to Syria, Yemen, Gaza, and Lebanon, where Hezbollah long held Israel in a stalemate. But every node of what Khomeini called the axis of resistance was severely weakened after the October 7th, 2023 attack on Israel. The attack, which killed some 1,200 people, was carried out by Hamas, a Tehran client that expected help from others. That help came only fittingly, however, after while Israel mounted a series of campaigns that, after decimating Hezbollah and the military arsenal it threatened to unleash over the border if Israel dared to attack Tehran, that left Iran exposed. Also gone by the time of Khomeini's death, enforcement of the Islamic Republic's strict dress code for women, regarded as a pillar of the regime, its last remaining alliance with Venezuela, physical access to oil markets, cutting off a U.S. naval blockade, and perhaps most consequentially, the country's air defenses destroyed by the 12-day war. Question now is whether the regime survives the death of its master. We continue with our reading of Time magazine for March 23rd, the second part of that issue, with eight questions. Michael Fox, the actor and advocate for building his namesake foundation, living with Parkinson's disease, and what he's learned from bullies. First question. You've built the Michael J. Fox Foundation into a leading funder for research and breakthroughs in Parkinson's disease. How does the organization today fit with your initial vision? I wanted to be a nudge. I wanted to push things along. When I first got diagnosed at 29, I was motivated by what I heard from the science people who said the science is ahead of the money. They said, if you can direct money toward the right research, we can speed things along. I got the sense from scientists that there were a few key questions away. Has the pace of progress matched what you were initially hoping to see? No, I was very arrogant. I say that with all due respect to everything we've done, and we've done a lot, but we haven't cured Parkinson's, and until you do, it's not done. Do people in other advocacy groups come to you and ask how you built the foundation to be the force that it is now, and how do you replicate it? Yeah, and I'm stuck for an answer. A lot of times, we were two hands in the dark, feeling our way through. To support our initial research, I went to a lot of business people, and I knew that they wanted to win, so I appealed to that ego side of them, to the winners who wanted to win, and I said, let's win against this disease. I'll come to your office. I'll take pictures with all your employees. I'll pound you for money. When you look at the things the foundation has funded, that could potentially lead to a cure. What are you most excited about today? I'm most excited about what we've done with biomarkers and the genetic front. Genetics loaded a gun and environment pulled the trigger, so that we need to find the environment triggers too. But I think that I'm also proud of a Parkinson's patients now have identity and they don't have shame. There was a feeling when I came in that it was an old person's disease. Now people say, I have what Michael Fox has. What has it been like to be open about living with Parkinson's? I took 7 years before I disclosed my diagnosis. But when I did, I went online and into Parkinson's chat rooms, and I would go in anonymously, and I would ask, what do you think of this Michael Fox thing? And they say, it's great. I would think, you're celebrating my having Parkinson's. But then I got it and realized that these people were stuck in the rocking chair on their porch for all this time, just to whittle away until they can't move, and never had a part in solving their problems. The more I thought about it, the more I thought it was a privilege, and in a way a gift. It's a gift that keeps on taking. If you could travel back in time, what would you say to your younger self? Just be tough and get it done. I was always a small guy. I was bullied and pushed around. I would overcome that and push through. Parkinson's is the biggest bully there is for me. And I'm not just going to let it get its way. We're going to have a fight, and I'm going to get a few punches in. I may get beat up in the long run, but we'll get it done. I'm a, pardon my language, a son of a bee, and I'm going to get it done. And what about 30 years in the future? I'd like to see a world without Parkinson's, and I think that will happen. I think in 30, 40 years, this will be done. Optimism is a powerful thing. Last question. What would your message for people facing life-changing diagnosis? Just be there every day and show up. Don't just look for bad things. Look for things that are getting better, that you can change, where you have an effect. And we'll end our reading of Time magazine for March 23rd, the second part of our double issue, with a couple of items from Milestones. First, switched BC to DST, a constant clock. Things will be sunnier in British Columbia going forward. That's because the Canadian province decided that after it sets its clock ahead for daylight savings time, DST, on March 8th, it's not going back to standard time in the fall. Polls showing the move is popular, but it comes with risks. On daylight time, clock's time is less aligned with the sun than it is with the standard time, and that can mess our body's circadian rhythms, which in turn can lead to all manner of health woes. One 2025 paper estimated that eliminating DST would lower the U.S. prevalence of stroke by 300,000 cases. A Spanish study found that 30% increase in fatal car accidents from 1990 to 2014 on the day the clocks spring forward. A 2020 study found medical errors like giving the wrong medication to a patient rise by as much as 8.8% in the week following the switch. But even as the perils of DST become more evident, the U.S. is, if anything, moving in the wrong direction, with Congress annually considering a so-called Sunshine Protection Act that would follow BC in making DST permanent. But at least North America remains an outlier. Only about a third of the countries around the world observe daylight savings time at all. Resigned, Lawrence Descartes is the president of the Louvre Museum in Paris on February 24th. In October, a theft at the museum sparked concerns about its security measures. Convicted, Colin Gray, the father of teenage suspect in a 2024 shooting at Georgia's Appalachee High School of second-degree murder in connection with the shooting on March 3rd. Fired, Kristi Noem as Homeland Security Secretary, President Donald Trump announced on March 5th, saying she would be made a special envoy for the Shield of Americas. Noem has faced criticism for her oversight of Trump's immigrant crackdown. Died, Neil Sedaka, who co-wrote and sang pop hits of the 50s and 60s, including Breaking Up is Hard to Do, on February 27th. He was 86 years old. And that ends our reading of Time Magazine for this week, the second part of our double issue for March 23rd, 2026. This is Ken Fajera signing off. Hope you have a good week. It's starting to warm. We'll see you next week.